people that had been working on this were novices. Musk realized the same thing and tried to articulate what he wanted. Even though the words were not precise, they were good enough to give von Holzhausen a feel for Musk's vision and the confidence that he could deliver on it. I said, "We're going to start over. We're going to work together and make this awesome." To save money, the Tesla Design Center came to life inside the SpaceX factory. A handful of people on von Holzhausen's team took over one corner and put up a tent to add some separation and secrecy to what they were doing. In the tradition of many a Musk employee, von Holzhausen had to build his own office. He made a pilgrimage to IKEA to buy some desks and then went to an art store to get some paper and pens. As von Holzhausen began sketching the outside of the Model S, the Tesla engineers had started up a project to build another electric CLS. They ripped this one down to its very core, removing all of the body structure, and then stretching the wheelbase by 4 inches to match up with some of the early Model S specifications. Things began moving fast for everyone involved in the Model S project. In the span of about 3 months, von Holzhausen had designed 95% of what people see today with the Model S, and the engineers had started building a prototype exterior around the skeleton. Throughout this process, von Holzhausen and Musk talked every day. Their desks were close, and the man had a natural rapport. Musk said he wanted an aesthetic that borrowed from Aston Martin and Porsche and some specific functions. He insisted, for example, that the car seat 7 people. It was like, "Holy shit, how do we pull this off in a sedan?" von Holzhausen said. But I understood. He had 5 kids and wanted something that could be thought of as a family vehicle, and he knew other people would have this issue. Musk wanted to make another statement with a huge touchscreen. This was years before the iPad would be released. The touchscreens that people ran into now and again at airports or shopping kiosks were for the most part terrible. But to Musk, the iPhone and all of its touch functions made it obvious that this type of technology would soon become commonplace. He would make a giant iPhone and have it handle most of the car's functions. To find the right size for the screen, Musk and von Holzhausen would sit in a skeleton car and hold up laptops of different sizes, placing them horizontally and vertically to see what looked best. They settled on a 17-inch screen in a vertical position. Drivers would tap on this screen for every task except for opening the glove box and turning on the emergency lights, jobs required by law to be performed with physical buttons. Since the battery pack at the base of the car would weigh so much, Musk, the designers, and the engineers were always looking for ways to reduce the Model S's weight in other spots. Musk opted to solve a big chunk of this problem by making the body of the Model S out of lightweight aluminum instead of steel. The non-battery pack portion of the car has to be lighter than comparable gasoline cars, and making it all aluminum became the obvious decision, Musk said. The fundamental problem was that if we didn't make it out of aluminum, the car wasn't going to be any good. Musk's word choice there, obvious decision, goes a long way toward explaining how he operates. Yes, the car needed to be light, and yes, aluminum would be an option for making that happen. But at the time, car manufacturers in North America had almost no experience producing aluminum body panels. Aluminum tends to tear when worked by large presses. It also develops lines that look like stretch marks on skin and make it difficult to lay down smooth coats of paint. In Europe, you had some Jaguars and one Audi that were made of aluminum, but it was less than 5% of the market, Musk said. In North America, there was nothing. It's only recently that the Ford F-150 has arrived as mostly aluminum. Before that, we were the only one. Inside of Tesla, attempts were repeatedly made to talk Musk out of the aluminum body, but he would not budge, seeing it as the only rational choice. It would be up to the Tesla team to figure out how to make the aluminum manufacturing happen. "We knew it could be done," Musk said. "It was a question of how hard it would be and how long it would take us to sort it out. Just about all of the major design choices with the Model S came with similar challenges. When we first talked about the touchscreen, the guys came back and said, "There's nothing like that in the automotive supply chain," Musk said. I said, "I know. That's because it's never been put in a fucking car before." Musk figured that computer manufacturers had tons of experience making 17-inch laptop screens and expected them to knock out a screen for the Model S with relative ease. "The laptops are pretty robust," Musk said. "You can drop them and leave them out in the sun, and they still have to work." After contacting the laptop suppliers, Tesla's engineers came back and said that the temperature and vibration loads for the computers did not appear to be up to automotive standards. Tesla's supplier in Asia also kept pointing the car maker to its automotive division instead of its computing division. As Musk dug into the situation more, he discovered that the laptop screens simply had not been tested before under the tougher automotive conditions, which included large temperature fluctuations. When Tesla performed the tests, the electronics ended up working just fine. Tesla also started working hand-in-hand with the Asian manufacturers to perfect their then-immature capacitive touch technology and to find ways to hide the wiring behind the screen that made the touch technology possible. "I'm pretty sure that we ended up with the only 17-inch touchscreen in the world," Musk said. None of the computer makers or Apple had made it work yet. The Tesla engineers were radical by automotive industry standards, but even they had problems fully committing to Musk's vision. "They wanted to put in a bloody switch or a button for the lights," Musk said. "Why would we need a switch? When it's dark, turn the lights on." Next, the engineers put up resistance to the door handles. Musk and von Holzhausen had been studying a bunch of preliminary designs in which the handles had yet to be drawn in, and started to fall in love with how clean the car looked. They decided that the handles should only present themselves when a passenger needed to get in the car. Right away, the engineers realized this would be a technological pain, and they completely ignored the idea in one prototype version of the car, much to the dismay of Musk and von Holzhausen. "This prototype had the handles pivot instead of popping out," von Holzhausen said. "I was upset about it, and Elon said, 'Why the fuck is this different? We're not doing this.'" To crank up the pace of the Model S design, there were engineers working all day and then others who would show up at 9 p.m. and work through the night. Both groups huddled inside of the 3,000-square-foot tent placed on the SpaceX factory floor. Their workspace looked like a reception area at an outdoor wedding. The SpaceX guys were amazingly respectful and didn't peek or ask questions, said Ali Javidan, one of the main engineers. As von Holzhausen delivered his specifications, the engineers built the prototype body of the car. Every Friday afternoon, they brought what they had made into a courtyard behind the factory, where Musk would look it over and provide feedback. To run tests on the body, the car would be loaded up with ballast to represent 5 people, and then do loops around the factory until it overheated or broke down. The more von Holzhausen learned about Tesla's financial struggles, the more he wanted the public to see the Model S. "Things were so precarious, and I didn't want to miss our opportunity to get this thing finished and show it to the world," he said. That moment came in March 2009, when just 6 months after von Holzhausen had arrived, Tesla unveiled the Model S at a press event held at SpaceX. Amid rocket engines and hunks of aluminum, Tesla showcased a gray Model S sedan. From a distance, the display model looked glamorous and refined. The media reports from the day described the car as the love child of an Aston Martin and a Maserati. In reality, the sedan barely held together. It still had the base structure of a Mercedes CLS, although no one in the press knew that, and some of the body panels and the hood were stuck to the frame with magnets. "They could just slide the hood right off," said Bruce Leake, a Tesla owner invited to attend the event. "It wasn't really attached. They would put it back on and try and align it to get the fit and finish right, but then someone would push on it and it would move again. It was one of those Wizard of Oz man-behind-the-curtain moments." A couple of the Tesla engineers practiced test driving the car for a couple of days leading up to the event to make sure that they knew just how long the car would go before it overheated. While not perfect, the display accomplished exactly what Musk had intended. It reminded people that Tesla had a credible plan to make electric cars more mainstream, and that its cars were far more ambitious than what big-time automakers like GM and Nissan seemed to have in mind, both from a design and a range perspective. The messy reality behind the display was that the odds of Tesla advancing the Model S from a prop to a sellable car were infinitesimal. The company had the technical know-how and the will for the job. It just didn't have much money or a factory that could crank out cars by the thousands. Building an entire car would require blanking machines that take sheets of aluminum and chop them up into the appropriate size for doors, hoods, and body panels. Next up would be the massive stamping machines and metal dies used to take the aluminum and bend it into precise shapes. Then there would be dozens of robots that would aid in assembling the cars, computer-controlled milling machines for precise metalwork, painting equipment, and a bevy of other machines for running tests. It was an investment that would run into the hundreds of millions of dollars. Musk would also need to hire thousands of workers. As with SpaceX, Musk preferred to build as much of Tesla's vehicles in-house as possible. But the high costs were limiting just how much Tesla could take on. "The original plan was that we would do final assembly," said Diarmuid O'Connell, the vice president of business development at Tesla. "Partners would stamp out the body parts, do the welding and handle the painting, and ship everything to Tesla, where workers would turn the parts into a whole car. Tesla proposed to build a factory to handle this type of work, first in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and then later in San Jose, California, and then pulled back on these proposals, much to the dismay of city officials in both locales. The public hemming and hawing around picking the factory site did little to inspire confidence in Tesla's ability to knock out a second car, and generated the same type of negative headlines that had surrounded the Roadster's protracted delivery. O'Connell had joined Tesla in 2006 to help solve some of the factory and financing issues. He grew up near Boston in a middle-class Irish family and went on to earn a bachelor's degree from Dartmouth College. After that, O'Connell attended the University of Virginia to get a master's degree in foreign policy and then Northwestern, where he got an MBA from the Kellogg School of Management. He had fancied himself a scholar of the Soviet Union and its foreign and economic policy, and had studied these areas at UVA. But then, in 1988 and 1989, they're starting to close down the Soviet Union, and at the very least, I had a brand problem, O'Connell said. It started looking to me like I was heading to a career in academia or intelligence. It was then that O'Connell's career took a detour into the business world, where he became a management consultant working for McCann Erickson Worldwide, Young & Rubicam, and Accenture, advising companies like Coca-Cola and AT&T. O'Connell's career path changed more drastically in 2001 when the planes hit the Twin Towers in New York. In the wake of the terrorist attacks, O'Connell, like many people, decided to serve the United States in any capacity that he could. In his late 30s, he had missed the window to be a soldier and instead focused his attention on trying to get into national security work. O'Connell went from office to office in Washington, D.C., looking for a job, and had little luck until Lincoln Bloomfield, the Assistant Secretary of State for Political Military Affairs, heard him out. Bloomfield needed someone who could help prioritize missions in the Middle East and make sure the right people were working on the right things, and he figured that O'Connell's management consulting experience made him a nice fit for the job. O'Connell became Bloomfield's chief of staff and dealt with a wide range of charged situations, from trade negotiations to setting up an embassy in Baghdad. After gaining security clearance, O'Connell also had access to a daily report that collected information from intelligence and military personnel on the status of operations in Iraq and Afghanistan. "Every morning at 6 a.m., the first thing to hit my desk was this overnight report that included information on who got killed and what killed them, O'Connell said. I kept thinking, this is insane. Why are we in this place? It was not just Iraq, but the whole picture. Why are we so invested in that part of the world? The unsurprising answer that O'Connell came up with was oil. The more O'Connell dug into the United States' dependence on foreign oil, the more frustrated and despondent he became. My clients were basically the combat commanders, people in charge of Latin America and Central Command, he said. As I talked with them and studied and researched, I realized that even in peacetime, so many of our assets were employed to support the economic pipeline around oil. O'Connell decided that the rational thing to do for his country and for his newborn son was to alter this equation. He looked at the wind industry and the solar industry and the traditional automakers, but came away unconvinced that what they were doing could have a radical enough impact on the status quo. Then, while reading Business Week, he stumbled on an article about a startup called Tesla Motors and went to the company's website, which described Tesla as a place where we are doing things, not talking about things. I sent an email telling them I had come from the national security area and was really passionate about reducing our dependence on oil, and figured it was just a dead letter type of thing, O'Connell said. I got an email back the next day. Musk hired O'Connell and quickly dispatched him to Washington, D.C. to start poking around on what types of tax credits and rebates Tesla might be able to drum up around its electric vehicles. At the same time, O'Connell drafted an application for a Department of Energy stimulus package. It took a couple of years, from about 2007 to 2009, for the Energy Department application to morph into the actual possibility of a loan from the government. All I knew is that we were going to need a shitload of money to build this company, O'Connell said. My view was that we needed to explore everything. Tesla had been looking for between $100 million and $200 million, grossly underestimating what it would take to build the Model S. We were naive and learning our way in the business, O'Connell said. In January 2009, Tesla took over Porsche's usual spot at the Detroit Auto Show, getting the space cheap because so many other car companies had bailed out on the event. Fisker had a luxurious booth across the hallway with wood flooring and pretty blonde booth babes draped over its car. Tesla had the Roadster, its electric powertrain, and no frills. The technology that Tesla's engineers displayed proved good enough to attract the attention of the big boys. Not long after the show, Daimler voiced some interest in seeing what an electric Mercedes A-Class car might look and feel like. Daimler executives said they would visit Tesla in about a month to discuss this proposition in detail, and the Tesla engineers decided to blow them away by producing two prototype vehicles before the visit. When the Daimler executives saw what Tesla had done, they ordered 4,000 of Tesla's battery packs for a fleet of test vehicles in Germany. The Tesla team pulled off the same kind of feats for Toyota and won its business too. In May 2009, things started to take off for Tesla. The Model S had been unveiled, and Daimler followed that by acquiring a 10% stake in Tesla for $50 million. The companies also formed a strategic partnership to have Tesla provide the battery packs for 1,000 of Daimler's smart cars. That money was important and went a long way back then, said O'Connell. It was also a validation. Here is the company that invented the internal combustion engine, and they are investing in us. It was a seminal moment, and I am sure it gave the guys over at the DOE the feeling that we were real. It's not just our scientists saying this stuff is good. It's Mercedes freaking Benz. Sure enough, in January 2010, the Department of Energy struck a $465 million loan agreement with Tesla. The deal had two parts. Tesla would keep making battery packs and associated technology that other companies might use, and it would produce its own electric vehicles at a manufacturing facility in the United States. The money was far more than Tesla had ever expected to get from the government, but it still represented just a fraction of the $1 billion plus that most car makers needed to bring a new vehicle to market. So while Musk and O'Connell were thrilled to get the money, they still wondered if Tesla would be able to live up to the bargain. Tesla would need one more windfall, or perhaps, to steal a car factory. And in May 2010, that's more or less what it did. General Motors and Toyota had teamed up in 1984 to build New United Motor Manufacturing, Inc., or NUMMI, on the site of a former GM assembly plant in Fremont, California, a city on the outskirts of Silicon Valley. The companies hoped the joint facility would combine the best of American and Japanese automaking skills and result in higher quality, cheaper cars. The factory went on to pump out millions of vehicles like the Chevy Nova and Toyota Corolla. Then the recession hit, and GM found itself trying to climb out of bankruptcy. It decided to abandon the plant in 2009, and Toyota followed right after, saying it would close down the whole facility, leaving 5,000 people without jobs. All of a sudden, Tesla had the chance to buy a 5.3 million square foot plant in its backyard. Just 1 month after the last Toyota Corolla went off the manufacturing line in April 2010, Tesla and Toyota announced a partnership and transfer of the factory. Tesla agreed to pay $42 million for a large portion of the factory, once worth $1 billion, while Toyota invested $50 million in Tesla for a 2.5% stake in the company. Tesla had basically secured a factory, including the massive metal stamping machines and other equipment, for free. Musk had received a lot of pushback internally for trying to locate a car factory in or near California. All the guys in Detroit said it needs to be in a place where the labor can afford to live and be happy, Lloyd said. There's a lot of learned skill on an assembly line, and you can't afford turnover. Musk responded that SpaceX had found a way to build rockets in Los Angeles, and that Tesla would find a way to build cars in Northern California. His stubbornness ended up being fortuitous for the company. If it hadn't been for that DOE loan and the NUMMI plant, there's no way Tesla would have ended up being so successful so fast, Lloyd said. The string of fortunate turns for Tesla left Musk feeling good. Just after the factory deal closed in the summer of 2010, Tesla started the process of filing for an initial public offering. The company obviously needed as much capital as it could get to bring the Model S to market and push forward with its other technology projects. Tesla hoped to raise about $200 million. For Musk, going public represented something of a Faustian bargain. Ever since the Zip2 and PayPal days, Musk has done everything in his power to maintain absolute control over his companies. Even if he remained the largest shareholder in Tesla, the company would be subjected to the capricious nature of the public markets. Musk, the ultimate long-term thinker, would face constant second-guessing from investors looking for short-term returns. Tesla would also be subject to public scrutiny, as it would be forced to open its books for public consumption. This was bad because Musk prefers to operate in secrecy, and because Tesla's financial situation looked awful. The company had one product, the Roadster, had huge development costs, and had bordered on bankruptcy months earlier. The car blog Jalopnik greeted the Tesla IPO as a Hail Mary rather than a sound fiscal move. For lack of a better phrase, Tesla is a money pit, the blog wrote. Since the company's founding in 2003, it's managed to incur over $290 million in losses on just $147.6 million in revenue. Told by a source that Tesla hoped to sell 20,000 units of the Model S per year at $58,000 a pop, Jalopnik scoffed. Even considering the supposed pent-up demand among environmentalists for a car like the Model S, those are ambitious goals for a small company planning to launch a niche luxury product into a soft market. Frankly, we're skeptical. We've seen how brutal and unforgiving the market can be, and other automakers aren't simply going to roll over and surrender that volume to Tesla. Other pundits concurred with this assessment. Tesla went public on June 29, 2010, nonetheless. It raised $226 million, with the company's shares shooting up 41% that day. Investors looked past Tesla's $55.7 million loss in 2009 and the more than $300 million the company had spent in 7 years. The IPO stood as the first for an American carmaker since Ford went public in 1956. Competitors continued to treat Tesla like an annoying, ankle-biting dachshund. Nissan CEO Carlos Ghosn used the event to remind people that Tesla was but a pipsqueak and that his company had plans to pump out up to 500,000 electric cars by 2012. Flush with funds, Musk began expanding some of the engineering teams and formalizing the development work around the Model S. Tesla's main offices moved from San Mateo to a larger building in Palo Alto, and von Holzhausen expanded the design team in Los Angeles. Javedan hopped between projects, helping develop technology for the electrified Mercedes-Benz, an electric Toyota RAV4, and prototypes of the Model S. The Tesla team worked fast inside of a tiny lab with about 45 people knocking out 35 RAV4 test vehicles at the rate of about 2 cars per week. The alpha version of the Model S, including newly stamped body, parts from the Fremont factory, a revamped battery pack, and revamped power electronics, came to life in the basement of the Palo Alto office. The first prototype was finished at about 2 a.m., Javedan said. We were so excited that we drove it around without glass, any interior, or a hood. A day or two later, Musk came to check out the vehicle. He jumped into the car and drove it to the opposite end of the basement, where he could spend some time alone with it. He got out and walked around the vehicle, and then the engineers came over to hear his take on the machine. This process would be repeated many times in the months to come. He would generally be positive, but constructive, Javedan said. We would try and get him rides whenever we could, and he might ask for the steering to be tighter, or something like that, before running off to another meeting. About a dozen of the Alpha cars were produced. A couple went to suppliers like Bosch to begin work on the braking systems, while others were used for various tests and design tweaks. Tesla's executives kept the vehicles rotating on a strict schedule, giving one team 2 weeks for cold weather testing and then shipping that Alpha car to another team right away for powertrain tuning. The guys from Toyota and Daimler were blown away, Javedan said. They might have 200 Alpha cars and several hundred to 1,000 beta cars. We were doing everything from crash tests to the interior design with about 15 cars. That was amazing to them. Tesla employees developed similar techniques to their counterparts at SpaceX for dealing with Musk's high demands. The savvy engineers knew better than to go into a meeting and deliver bad news without some sort of alternative plan at the ready. One of the scariest meetings was when we needed to ask Elon for an extra 2 weeks and more money to build out another version of the Model S, Javedan said. We put together a plan, stating how long things would take and what they would cost. We told him that if he wanted the car in 30 days, it would require hiring some new people, and we presented him with a stack of resumes. You don't tell Elon you can't do something. That will get you kicked out of the room. You need everything lined up. After we presented the plan, he said, "Okay, thanks." Everyone was like, "Holy shit, he didn't fire you." There were times when Musk would overwhelm the Tesla engineers with his requests. He took a Model S prototype home for a weekend and came back on the Monday asking for around 80 changes. Since Musk never writes anything down, he held all the alterations in his head and would run down the checklist week by week to see what the engineers had fixed. The same engineering rules as those at SpaceX applied. You did what Musk asked, or were prepared to burrow down into the properties of materials to explain why something could not be done. He always said, "Take it down to the physics," Javidan said. As the development of the Model S neared completion in 2012, Musk refined his requests and dissection style. He went over the Model S with von Holzhausen every Friday at Tesla's design studio in Los Angeles. Von Holzhausen and his small team had moved out of the corner in the SpaceX factory and gotten their own hangar-shaped facility near the rear of the SpaceX complex. Boeing used to make fuselages for the 747 in the SpaceX building and painted them in what became the Tesla Design Studio. The building had a few offices and then one large, wide-open area where various mock-ups of vehicles and parts awaited inspection. During a visit I made in 2012, there was one complete Model S, a skeletal version of the Model X, an as-yet-to-be-released SUV, and a selection of tires and hubcaps lined up against the wall. Musk sank into the Model S driver's seat, and von Holzhausen climbed into the passenger seat. Musk's eyes darted around for a few moments and then settled onto the sun visor. It was beige, and a visible seam ran around the edge and pushed the fabric out. "It's fish-lipped," Musk said. The screws attaching the visor to the car were visible as well, and Musk insisted that every time he saw them, it felt like tiny daggers were stabbing him in the eyes. The whole situation was unacceptable. "We have to decide what is the best sun visor in the world and then do better," Musk said. A couple of assistants taking notes outside of the car jotted this down. This process played out again with the Model X. This was to be Tesla's merger of an SUV and a minivan, built off the Model S foundation. Von Holzhausen had four different versions of the vehicle's center console resting on the floor, so that they could be slotted in one by one and viewed by Musk. The pair spent most of their time, however, agonizing over the middle row of seats. Each one had an independent base so that each passenger could adjust his seat rather than moving the whole row collectively. Musk loved the freedom this gave the passenger, but grew concerned after seeing all three seats in different positions. "The problem is that they will never be aligned and might look a mess," Musk said. "We have to make sure they are not too hodgy-podgy." The idea of Musk as a design expert has long struck me as bizarre. He's a physicist at heart and an engineer by demeanor. So much of who Musk is says that he should fall into that Silicon Valley stereotype of the schlubby nerd who would only know good design if he read about it in a textbook. The truth is that there might be some of that going on with Musk, and he's turned it into an advantage. He's very visual and can store things that others have deemed to look good away in his brain for recall at any time. This process has helped Musk develop a good eye, which he's combined with his own sensibilities, while also refining his ability to put what he wants into words. The result is a confident, assertive perspective that does resonate with the tastes of consumers. Like Steve Jobs before him, Musk is able to think up things that consumers did not even know they wanted, the door handles, the giant touchscreen, and to envision a shared point of view for all of Tesla's products and services. "Elon holds Tesla up as a product company," von Holzhausen said. "He's passionate that you have to get the product right. I have to deliver for him and make sure it's beautiful and attractive." With the Model X, Musk again turned to his role as a dad to shape some of the flashiest design elements of the vehicle. He and von Holzhausen were walking around the floor of an auto show in Los Angeles, and they both complained about the awkwardness of getting to the middle and back row seats in an SUV. Parents who have felt their backs wrench while trying to angle a child and car seat into a vehicle know this reality all too well, as does any decent-sized human who has tried to wedge into a third row seat. Even on a minivan, which is supposed to have more room, almost one-third of the entry space is covered by the sliding door, von Holzhausen said. If you could open up the car in a way that is unique and special, that could be a real game-changer. We took that kernel of an idea back and worked up 40 or 50 design concepts to solve the problem, and I think we ended up with one of the most radical ones. The Model X has what Musk coined as Falcon Wing doors. They're hinged versions of the Gull Wing doors found on some high-end cars like the DeLorean. The doors go up and then flop over in a constrained enough way that the Model X won't rub up against a car parked close to it or hit the ceiling in a garage. The end result is that a parent can plop a child in the second row passenger seat without needing to bend over or twist at all. When Tesla's engineers first heard about the Falcon Wing doors, they cringed. Here was Musk with another crazy ask. "Everyone tried to come up with an excuse as to why we couldn't do it," Chavadan said. "You can't put it in the garage. It won't work with things like skis." Then Elon took a demo model to his house and showed us that the doors opened. Everyone is mumbling, "Yeah, in a $15 million house, the doors will open just fine." Like the controversial door handles on the Model S, the Model X's doors have become one of its most striking features and the thing consumers talk about the most. "I was one of the first people to test it out with a kid's car seat," Chavadan said. "We have a minivan, and you have to be a contortionist to get the seat into the middle row. Compared to that, the Model X was so easy. If it's a gimmick, it's a gimmick that works." During my 2012 visit to the design studio, Tesla had a number of competitors' vehicles in the parking lot nearby, and Musk made sure to demonstrate the limitations of their seating compared to the Model X. He tried with honest effort to sit in the third row of an Acura SUV, but even though the car claimed to have room for seven, Musk's knees were pressed up to his chin, and he never really fit into the seat. "That's like a midget cave," he said. "Anyone can make a car big on the outside. The trick is to make it big on the inside." Musk went from one rival's car to the next, illuminating the vehicle's flaws for me and von Holzhausen. "It's good to get a sense for just how bad the other cars are," he said. When these statements fly out of Musk's mouth, it's momentarily shocking. Here's a guy who needed 9 years to produce about 3,000 cars, ridiculing automakers that build millions of vehicles every year. In that context, his ribbing comes off as absurd. Musk, though, approaches everything from a platonic perspective. As he sees it, all of the design and technology choices should be directed toward the goal of making a car as close to perfect as possible. To the extent that rival automakers haven't, that's what Musk is judging. It's almost a binary experience for him. Either you're trying to make something spectacular with no compromises, or you're not. And if you're not, Musk considers you a failure. This position can look unreasonable or foolish to outsiders, but the philosophy works for Musk and constantly pushes him and those around him to their limits. On June 22, 2012, Tesla invited all of its employees, some select customers, and the press to its factory in Fremont to watch as the first Model S sedans were taken home. Depending on which of the many promised delivery dates you pick, the Model S was anywhere from 18 months to 2-plus years late. Some of the delays were a result of Musk's requests for exotic technologies that needed to be invented. Other delays were simply a function of this still quite young automaker learning how to produce an immaculate luxury vehicle and needing to go through the trial and error tied to becoming a more mature, more refined company. The outsiders were blown away by their first glimpse of the Tesla factory. Musk had TESLA painted in enormous black letters on the side of the building so that people driving by on the freeway, or flying above for that matter, were made well aware of the company's presence. The inside of the factory, once dressed in the dark, dingy tones of General Motors and Toyota, had taken on the Musk aesthetic. The floors received a white epoxy. The walls and beams were painted white. The 30-foot-tall stamping machines were white. And then, much of the other machinery, like the teams of robots, had been painted red, making the place look like an industrial version of Santa Claus's workshop. Just as he did at SpaceX, Musk placed the desks of his engineers right on the factory floor, where they worked in an area cordoned off by rudimentary cubicle dividers, Musk had a desk in this area as well. He picks the most visible place on purpose, said the investor and Tesla board member Steve Jurvetson. He's at Tesla just about every Saturday and Sunday, and wants people to see him and know they can find him. Then he can also call suppliers on the weekend and let them know that he's personally putting in the hours on the factory floor and expects the same from them. The Model S launch event took place in a section of the factory where they finish off the cars. There's a part of the floor with various grooves and bumps that the cars pass over, as technicians listen for any rattles. There's also a chamber where water can be sprayed at high pressure onto the car to check for leaks. For the very last inspection, the Model S cruises onto a raised platform made out of bamboo, which, when coupled with lots of LED lighting, is meant to provide an abundant amount of contrast so that people can spot flaws on the body. For the first few months that the Model S came off the line, Musk went to this bamboo stage to inspect every vehicle. He was down on all fours looking up under the wheel well, said Steve Jurvetson, the investor and Tesla board member. Hundreds of people had gathered around this stage to watch as the first dozen or so cars were presented to their owners. Many of the employees were factory workers who had once been part of the auto workers union, lost their jobs when the NUMMI plant closed, and were now back at work again, making the car of the future. They waved American flags and wore red, white, and blue visors. A handful of the workers cried as the Model S sedans were lined up on the stage. Even Musk's most cynical critics would have softened for a moment while watching the proceedings. Say what you will about Tesla receiving government money or hyping up the promise of the electric car. It was trying to do something big and different, and people were getting hired by the thousands as a result. With machines humming in the background, Musk gave a brief speech and then handed the owners their keys. They drove off the bamboo platform and out the factory doors, while the Tesla employees provided a standing ovation. Just 4 weeks earlier, SpaceX had flown cargo to the International Space Station and had its capsule returned to Earth. Firsts all around for a private company. That feat, coupled with the launch of the Model S, led to a rapid transformation in the way the world outside of Silicon Valley perceived Musk. The guy who was always promising, 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 was doing, and doing spectacular things. I may have been optimistic with respect to the timing on some of these things, but I didn't overpromise on the outcome, Musk told me during an interview after the Model S launch. I have done everything I said I was going to do. Musk did not have Riley around to celebrate with and share in this run of good fortune. They had divorced, and Musk had begun to think about dating again, if he could find the time. Even with this turmoil in his personal life, however, Musk had reached a point of calm that he had not felt in many years. My main emotion is that there is a bit of weight off my shoulders, he said at the time. Musk took his boys to Maui to meet up with Kimball and other relatives, marking his first real vacation in a number of years. It was right after this holiday that Musk let me have the first substantial glimpse into his life. Skin still peeling off his sunburnt arms, Musk met with me at the Tesla and SpaceX headquarters, at the Tesla Design Studio, and at a Beverly Hills screening of a documentary he had helped sponsor. The film, Baseball in the Time of Cholera, was good but grim, and explored a cholera outbreak in Haiti. It turned out that Musk had visited Haiti the previous Christmas, filling his jet with toys and MacBook Airs for an orphanage. Bryn Musser, the co-director of the film, told me that during a barbecue, Musk had taught the kids how to fire off model rockets, and then later went to visit a village deeper in the jungle by traveling in a dugout canoe. After the screening, Musk and I hung out on the street for a bit, away from the crowd. I noted aloud that everyone wants to make him out as the Tony Stark character, but that he didn't really exude that playboy drinking scotch while zooming through Afghanistan in an army convoy vibe. He fired back, pointing to the Haitian canoe ride. I got wasted, too, on some drink they call the zombie, Musk said. He smiled and then invited me to grab some drinks across the street at Mr. Chow to celebrate the movie. All seemed to be going well for Musk, and he savored the moment. This restful period did not last long, and soon enough, Tesla's battle for survival resumed. The company could only produce about 10 sedans per week at the outset, and had thousands of back orders that it needed to fulfill. Short sellers, those investors who bet a company's share price will fall, had taken huge positions in Tesla, making it the most shorted stock out of 100 of the largest companies listed on the NASDAQ exchange. The naysayers expected numerous Model S flaws to crop up and undermine the enthusiasm for the car, to the point that people started canceling their orders in bulk. There were also huge doubts that Tesla could ramp up production in a meaningful way and do so profitably. In October 2012, the presidential hopeful Mitt Romney dubbed Tesla a loser, while slagging off a couple of other government-backed green technology companies, the solar panel maker Solyndra and Fisker, during a debate with Barack Obama. While the doubters placed huge wagers on Tesla's impending failure, Musk's bluster mode engaged. He began talking about Tesla's goals to become the most profitable major automobile maker in the world, with better margins than BMW. Then, in September 2012, he unveiled something that shocked both Tesla critics and proponents alike. Tesla had secretly been building the first leg of a network of charging stations. The company disclosed the location of 6 stations in California, Nevada, and Arizona, and promised that hundreds more would be on the way. Tesla intended to build a global charging network that would let Model S owners making long drives pull off the highway and recharge very quickly, and they would be able to do so for free. In fact, Musk insisted that Tesla owners would soon be able to travel across the United States without spending a penny on fuel. Model S drivers would have no trouble finding these stations, not only because the car's onboard computers would guide them to the nearest one, but because Musk and von Holzhausen had designed giant red and white monoliths to herald the appearance of the stations. The supercharging stations, as Tesla called them, represented a huge investment for the strapped company. An argument could easily be made that spending money on this sort of thing at such a precarious moment in the Model S and Tesla's history was somewhere between daft and batshit crazy. Surely Musk did not have the gall to try to revamp the very idea of the automobile and build an energy network at the same time, with a budget equivalent to what Ford and ExxonMobil spend on their annual holiday parties. But that was the exact plan. Musk, Straubel, and others inside Tesla had mapped out this all-or-nothing play long ago and built certain features into the Model S with the superchargers in mind. Tesla got its start using the same lithium-ion batteries that go into consumer electronics like laptops. During the early days of the Roadster, this proved a risky but calculated choice. Tesla wanted to tap into Asia's mature battery suppliers and get access to cheap products that would keep improving over time. The press played up Tesla's use of these types of batteries, and consumers were fascinated by the idea that a car could be powered by the same energy source sitting inside their gizmos. There's a major misconception that Tesla still depends on these types of batteries. Yes, the batteries inside the Model S look like those found in a laptop. Tesla, however, started developing its own battery chemistry in conjunction with partners like Panasonic, dating back to late models of the Roadster. Tesla can still use the same manufacturing equipment as consumer electronics companies while ending up with a battery that's safer and better tuned to the intense charging demands of its cars. Along with the secret formula for the battery cells themselves, Tesla has improved the performance of its batteries by developing its own techniques for linking the cells together and cooling them. The battery cells have been designed to vent heat in a very particular way, and there's coolant running throughout the entire battery pack. The battery packs are assembled at the Tesla factory in an area hidden from visitors. The chemistry, the batteries, the battery pack design, these are all elements of a large, continuous system that Tesla has built from the ground up to allow its cars to charge at record speed. to control the heat produced during the charging process. Tesla has designed an interlinked system of radiators and chillers to cool both the batteries and the chargers. You've got all that hardware plus the software management system and other controllers, said J.B. Straubel. All of these things are running at maximum rate. A Model S can recharge 150 miles of range in 20 minutes at one of Tesla's charging stations with DC power pumping straight into the batteries. By comparison, a Nissan Leaf that maxes out at 80 miles of range can take 8 hours to recharge. While the arrival of the Model S and the charging network garnered Tesla a ton of headlines, it remained unclear if the positive press and good vibes would last. Serious trade-offs had been made as Tesla rushed to get the Model S to market. The car had some spectacular, novel features. But everyone inside of the company knew that as far as luxury sedans went, the Model S did not match up feature to feature with cars from BMW and Mercedes-Benz. The first few thousand Model S cars, for example, would ship without the parking sensors and radar-assisted cruise control common on other high-end cars. It was either hire a team of 50 people right away to make one of these things happen, or implement things as best and as fast as you could, Javidan said. The subpar fit and finish also proved hard to explain. The early adopters could tolerate a windshield wiper going haywire for a couple of days, but they wanted to see seats and visors that met the $100,000 price tag. While Tesla did its best to source the highest quality materials, it struggled at times to convince the top suppliers to take the company seriously. People were very suspect that we would deliver 1,000 Model S's, said von Holzhausen. It was frustrating, because we had the drive internally to make the car perfect, but could not get the same commitment externally. With something like the visor, we ended up having to go to a third-rate supplier and then work on fixing the situation after the car had already started shipping. The cosmetic issues, though, were minor compared to a tumultuous set of internal circumstances revealed in detail here for the first time that threatened to bankrupt the company once again. Musk had hired George Blankenship, a former Apple executive, to run its stores and service center operations. At Apple, Blankenship worked just a couple of doors down from Steve Jobs and received credit for building much of the Apple store strategy. When Tesla first hired Blankenship, the press and public were a-twitter, anticipating that he'd do something spectacular and at odds with the traditions of the automotive industry. Blankenship did some of that. He expanded Tesla's number of stores throughout the world and imbued them with that Apple store vibe. Along with showcasing the Model S, the Tesla stores sold hoodies and hats and had areas in the back where kids would find crayons and Tesla coloring books. Blankenship gave me a tour of the Tesla store on Santana Row, the glitzy shopping center in San Jose. He came off as a warm, grandfatherly sort who saw Tesla as his chance to make a difference. The typical dealer wants to sell you a car on the spot to clear inventory off his lot, Blankenship said. The goal here is to develop a relationship with Tesla and electric vehicles. Tesla, he said, wanted to turn the Model S into more than a car. Ideally, it would be an object of desire just like the iPod and iPhone. Blankenship noted that Tesla had more than 10,000 reservations for the Model S at the time, the vast majority of which had arrived without the customers test-driving the car. A lot of this early interest resulted from the aura surrounding Musk, who Blankenship said came off as similar to Jobs, but with a toned-down control freak vibe. "This is the first place I have worked that is going to change the world," Blankenship said, taking a jab at the sometimes trivial nature of Apple's gadgets. While Musk and Blankenship got along at first, their relationship fell apart during the latter stages of 2012. Tesla did have a large number of reservations, in which people put down $5,000 for the right to buy a Model S and get in the purchase queue. But the company had struggled to turn these reservations into actual sales. The reasons behind this problem remain unclear. It may have been that the complaints about the interior and the early kinks mentioned on the Tesla forums and message boards were causing concerns. Tesla also lacked financing options to soften the blow of buying a $100,000 car, while uncertainty surrounded the resale market for the Model S. You might end up with the car of the future, or you might spend six figures on a dud with a battery pack that loses its capacity and with no secondary buyer. Tesla's service centers at the time were also terrible. The early cars were unreliable, and customers were being sent in droves to centers unprepared to handle the volume. Many prospective Tesla owners likely wanted to hang out on the sidelines for a bit longer to make sure that the company would remain viable. As Musk put it, the word of mouth on the car sucked. By the middle of February 2013, Tesla had fallen into a crisis state. If it could not convert its reservations to purchases quickly, its factory would sit idle, costing the company vast amounts of money. And if anyone caught wind of the factory slowdown, Tesla's shares would likely plummet, prospective owners would become even more cautious, and the short sellers would win. The severity of this problem had been hidden from Musk, but once he learned about it, he acted in his signature all-or-nothing fashion. Musk pulled people from recruiting, the design studio, engineering, finance, and wherever else he could find them, and ordered them to get on the phone, call people with reservations, and close deals. "If we don't deliver these cars, we are fucked," Musk told the employees. "So I don't care what job you are doing. Your new job is delivering cars." He placed Jerome Guillen, a former Daimler executive, in charge of fixing the service issues. Musk fired senior leaders whom he deemed subpar performers and promoted a flood of junior people who had been doing above-average work. He also made an announcement personally guaranteeing the resale price of the Model S. Customers would be able to resell their cars for the average going rate of similar luxury sedans, with Musk putting his billions behind this pledge. And then Musk tried to orchestrate the ultimate failsafe for Tesla, just in case his maneuvers did not work. During the first week of April, Musk reached out to his friend Larry Page at Google. According to people familiar with their discussion, Musk voiced his concerns about Tesla's ability to survive the next few weeks. Not only were customers failing to convert their reservations to orders at the rate Musk hoped, but existing customers had also started to defer their orders as they heard about upcoming features and new color choices. The situation got so bad that Tesla had to shut down its factory. Publicly, Tesla said it needed to conduct maintenance on the factory, which was technically true, although the company would have soldiered on had the orders been closing as expected. Musk explained all of this to Page, and then struck a handshake deal for Google to acquire Tesla. While Musk did not want to sell, the deal seemed like the only viable course for Tesla's future. Musk's biggest fear about an acquisition was that the new owner would not see Tesla's goals through to their conclusion. He wanted to make sure that the company would end up producing a mass-market electric vehicle. Musk proposed terms under which he would remain in control of Tesla for 8 years, or until it started pumping out a mass-market car. Musk also asked for access to $5 billion in capital for factory expansions. Some of Google's lawyers were put off by these demands, but Musk and Page continued to talk about the deal. Given Tesla's value at the time, it was thought that Google would need to pay about $6 billion for the company. As Musk, Page, and Google's lawyers debated the parameters of an acquisition, a miracle happened. The 500 or so people whom Musk had turned into car salesmen quickly sold a huge volume of cars. Tesla, which only had a couple weeks of cash left in the bank, moved enough cars in the span of about 14 days to end up with a blowout first fiscal quarter. Tesla stunned Wall Street on May 8, 2013, by posting its first ever profit as a public company, $11 million, on $562 million in sales. It delivered 4,900 Model S sedans during the period. This announcement sent Tesla's shares soaring from about $30 a share to $130 per share in July. Just a couple of weeks after revealing the first quarter results, Tesla